Thank you to the organizers for inviting me to this wonderful conference. I'm really pleased to be here. And let's just jump right in. This is the plan for my presentation. First, I will define this word that no one can spell or say, eudaimonia, and explain where is that. I shouldn't do that. So I want to talk a little bit about the theoretical and philosophical foundations of the approach to well-being that I have followed and define the key components of this model of eudaimonic well-being. And of course, I'm going to spend a fair amount of time looking at how eudaimonic well-being relates to health. And in that context, I will introduce you to the Midas study, Midlife in the U.S., that will be the basis for some, but not all, of the findings that I will summarize. Is it ringing? Or is it just? Okay, I apologize if I don't. Maybe I should stand way back here. It just sounds to me like it's ringing a bit. Okay, so in linking eudaimonic well-being to health, I'm going to look at biological risk factors, morbidity, mortality, also bring in some neuroscience. And the theme that I want to emphasize there is how eudaimonic well-being may serve important protective roles in keeping people healthy and well in the face of both the challenges of inequality and the challenges of aging. And then I'm going to briefly glimpse at some of the exciting work that is happening on the intervention front, introduce you to some of the work known as well-being therapy, describe some other more recent prevention strategies. And then I'm going to end with some free-floating observations about where I think things need to go in the future. So if we look at psychological research, there have been some reviews that make the point, I'm talking about a well-known review by Rich Ryan and Ed Deasy in the Annual Review of Psychology some years ago, that basically divided the study of well-being and psychological research into these two camps, the eudaimonic camp and the hedonic camp. My work fits into the eudaimonic side. It's not the only eudaimonic approach. Much of the work of Ed Diener and Danny Kahneman you could put into the hedonic formulation of well-being that is more about some of the things that have been emphasized at this conference: life satisfaction, sometimes assessments of happiness, and positive affect. But let me go into more detail about this model of well-being that I developed over 25 years ago. I was trained in lifespan developmental psychology. I also grew up in social gerontology. In social gerontology, I was very interested in the topic of successful aging. What does successful aging mean? And at that time, many people were studying life satisfaction, but there was never much in the way of, let me call it, a conceptual, theoretical foundation for what is life satisfaction and why should we care about it and where did it come from? And you could say the same thing about some of the key measures that were part of the social indicators movement in the U.S. in the 1960s and 70s. These were national studies of Americans asking them questions about happiness in their lives. Really important work done by the Institute of Survey Research at the University of Michigan. My perspective on all of that was, wait, there's a very large literature in developmental psychology, in humanistic and existential psychology, in clinical psychology, that has tried to articulate what are the key components of positive psychological functioning. And so that was the starting point for me. The hand in this graphic is symbolic of an effort to reach toward some other indicators of well-being that I think have deeper theoretical, conceptual foundations. And where I ended up was focusing on the six pieces of the lemon pie in the middle here, and I'll say more about each of those components of well-being in just a moment. But what I want to draw attention to is the blue part around what's in the center of the graphic, which summarizes these various approaches that I spend a lot of time reading and thinking about and asking myself, is there some way to come up with a formulation of well-being that builds on the best in all of these prior perspectives? So I didn't really feel like I wanted to spend the rest of my life just working with Eric Erickson's psychosocial stage model, although I used that model in some of my graduate research, and I didn't want to build my career around Maslow's self-actualization theory, although I read it and I thought it was important. What I wanted to do was focus on what I call the points of convergence in these various perspectives, because many of these formulations were reaching toward the same thing. And that's how I got to the six components of well-being that are in the middle of this graphic here. But let me just say something about Aristotle, which is where we get the word eudaimonia. I didn't read Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics at the beginning of this journey. I read it later in the process. And it was a big moment in my intellectual life to basically just follow his journey, reasoning his way through the question, what is the highest of all human goods? And his answer was that it is eudaimonia, which he defined as activity of the soul in accord with virtue. And then he pushed himself further to say, well, what is virtue? And in fact, what is the highest virtue? And his answer to that question, which is the heart of what is meant by eudaimonia, it is that it is about achieving the best that is within us, a kind of personal excellence. And because this was a book about ethics, it is about conducting ourselves ethically and responsibly. Other Greeks at the time, at that amazing period in Hellenic culture, were formulating the highest of all human goods in different ways, in terms of pleasure and satisfying appetites. And it's interesting to me that we have kind of come back to revisit these contrasting perspectives in contemporary research. My work has also been very much influenced by Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. This is the core of one dimension in the model, Purpose in Life, Finding Meaning in Life. So the model overall is an amalgamation of many different perspectives. It is in the spirit of Aristotle's formulation of eudaimonia, but some of the components come from other conceptual starting points as well. Each of the six dimensions, you probably can't read this, but each of the six dimensions gets defined based on these theoretical formulations in terms of both a high score and a low score, and then items are written to match these definitions. I underscore this to basically say, achieving a reasonably good fit between the theory that guides one's work and how you actually operationalize it is a long, complex, and tedious process. And I was guided by the construct-oriented approach to personality assessment in developing these scales. So with three or four undergraduates from the University of Wisconsin, we were sitting in my crummy little office writing items over a long period of time to try to operationalize these high and low scores on all of the dimensions. And I just put some of these up here. I'm happy to send people the scales if you want to take a look at them. We wrote lots of items. They were subjected to a lot of detailed item analysis. This is all in the spirit of it takes a lot of work to develop, I think, high-quality assessment tools. So here's some imagery to give you a little bit better flavor of the six key components. Autonomy is actually, I would say, the most Western of the components of well-being. It's really about marching to your own drummer, something Jung, in writing about the individuation process, called a deliverance from convention. Environmental mastery is about managing your external world and figuring out ways to sort of maximize the fit between your internal needs and capacities and what's available in the world around you. Personal growth, I would argue, is the dimension of well-being that comes closest to Aristotle's conception of eudaimonia. It's about making the most of your talents and capacities. Positive relations with others, taking care of your social ties, is, if you read philosophical and religious and psychological literatures, it is without question the most universally endorsed aspect of what it means to be functioning positively as a human being. And purpose in life, the illustration here is from Raphael's painting, The School of Athens. This is about finding meaning and direction in your life, having goals to live for, leading an examined life. And then self-acceptance is the last dimension. And I would argue it's richer and deeper than self-esteem, which has a long history of being studied by psychologists. But self-acceptance draws on the Jungian idea of the shadow. And the idea is that true self-acceptance, it also goes back to the Hellenic prescription to know yourself. It's about recognizing and accepting your strengths and weaknesses hopefully figuring out how to work with them effectively. So those scales were developed over 25 years ago. And in 2014, I put together this review article. At the time, there had been over 350 publications using these scales of well-being. They've been translated into more than 30 languages, and they're being used by researchers all over the world. The number is now up to 500 publications. I can't possibly keep up with all of this. But I wrote this review partly because I wanted to actually get my arms around what are people doing with these scales? What sorts of questions are they asking with them? So this review article is divided into these categories of emerging evidence about these scales of well-being. A lot of people have examined the psychometric properties of the scale. Does the six-factor model actually work? Some people have argued it does not. The majority of evidence has supported the six-factor model, and one thing that has become very important in adjudicating the dimensionality of the domain of well-being is paying attention to having adequate depth of measurement. It's critically important when you're measuring these kind of fuzzy, squishy psychological constructs that you have a decent number of items to get to feel confident that you're actually getting at the construct. Many people, I think because I came out of lifespan developmental psychology and intersected with many people in that world, many people are interested in the question of what happens to individuals' eudaimonic well-being as they age across the decades of adult life, and I'll say more about that in a moment. Many people have linked these components of well-being to individual difference variables, such as personality traits, and so we're learning something about the linkages between different categories of self-assessed psychological measures. I've been actually delighted to see family sociologists, people who work in occupational health, they have also embraced these measures, looking at transitions in family life, the transition to parenthood, divorce, widowhood, loss of a child. All of these things have been studied in terms of their impact on psychological well-being. Work, job stress has been linked to well-being, and we actually have quite a few publications linking volunteer experiences to well-being. I've been particularly interested in the links to health and physiological markers of risk. And then there's a category of studies dealing with efforts to promote well-being through intervention and clinical studies. So why has all of this interest happened? I don't know for sure. I'm speculating here, but I think it may stem from the fact that these phenomenological indicators, and from the beginning, I have been deeply interested in subjective experience. really trying to understand sort of the inside of what it feels to be well or not well. But presumably these phenomenological indicators capture core aspects of what it means to be human, that is to strive, to be proactive, to make meaning, and as articulated by Aristotle over 2,000 years ago, to pursue the highest good that is within us. So what have we learned from these measures? And this is my transition into the MIDAS study. MIDAS stands for midlife in the US. The study was begun in 1995 with over 7,000 US adults aged 25 to 74. It was conceived of by a multidisciplinary team of investigators funded by the MacArthur Foundation. We were members of what at the time was called the MacArthur Midlife Research Network. And the goal of the study, at that point it was only a survey study, was to advance knowledge of the factors that promote positive health and resilience. So we were bringing a lot of these positive psychological and social constructs into population-based research, knowing that many of these variables had only been studied previously in small select community samples. This is a graphic that gives you some sense of the content of the MIDAS study. It's big and broad and multidisciplinary. We bring in sociodemographic factors. There's an emphasis on genetics. There's a large twin sample within the MIDAS study. We focus on what's happening in people's lives, the chronic and acute life challenges that they're dealing with. We measure their daily stress experiences. There's a focus on health behaviors and practices, a lot of depth in the psychological and social factors. The box on neurobiological mechanisms assesses different aspects of emotion regulation in the brain, different physiological systems. The basic idea is that this wider array of sociodemographic, psychosocial, and behavioral things works through these brain and physiologically based mechanisms to basically help us understand pathways to different mental and physical health endpoints. So the reason I put this slide up is to just basically say, I'm here to talk about well-being, but there's so much more going on in MIDAS that I just want people to know about, and I'll make that clear in a minute. We collect this rich data via a project design. We were originally funded, the second wave of funding was funded by the National Institute on Aging. They gave resources to carry out a program project study. And the main point in this graphic is to say that we collect the data for these individuals across different projects, and not all of the projects have the full sample within them. So, for example, we bring people into one of three clinics across the U.S. for the biomarker assessment, and they come for 2 days. We actually put people on planes to bring them into these clinics for 2 days of assessments. That's a subsample of respondents, about 1,200 people from the baseline biomarker sample. And another subset at the University of Wisconsin, about 300 people in the baseline study, participated in a neuroscience assessment at the University of Wisconsin. This is our website, which I hope you will visit. The most important message here is that the MIDAS data are publicly available. Nobody has to get any kind of permission about anything. We have a huge following now in the scientific community. It's happening at an escalating rate. There are now 30,000 unique users of the MIDAS data based on our download statistics, and that number increased by 6,000 just in the last year. I would strongly encourage anybody who wants to learn about the data. You can learn about the data through this is how you get to data access through ICPSR, but the Collectica repository is another enjoyable, I think, for data geeks, an enjoyable mechanism for getting into the data. You can work with interactive code books. Some people are using the MIDAS data set actually to teach their classes on methods courses because it's just a fun data set to work with. But what I want to say is if you click on this tab, you get a drop-down menu, and that will, if you click on publications in that drop-down menu, it will take you to this tab without the numbers. But this is basically to just give you an overview of what are the topics that are being investigated with this rich data set. And these numbers here are below what the actual publications are now. These are constantly being updated. The numbers themselves are not there when you click to get to this table, but then you can click on any one of these topics, and those studies come up as PDFs. So this is a remarkable repository of information that you can move through very quickly. I want to draw attention to the fact that social inequalities in health is a big area of inquiry within MIDAS. Psychological well-being is a very big area of inquiry, and it's not just about people using my measures, it's about using other measures. There's also interesting work being done on volunteering, social responsibilities, and many other topics. Okay, so I'm making a lot of noise about publications from the study. This is because I have to constantly defend the fact that spending a lot of taxpayer dollars in the U.S. to fund this research is worth it. And part of how you make that case is you show that the scientific community, and this is an international group of users now, they have come to this study in droves and are using it. The publications have appeared in over 200 journals. The users of the data set come from more than 400 universities. So, and let me just note, we need more economists involved. I'll mention that again later. Okay, so some findings that I'm going to go through very quickly. I'm happy to share these, my slide files, the studies for people who are interested. A first important study from the MIDAS baseline data collection was to actually show that hedonic and eudaimonic well-being, also known as subjective well-being and psychological well-being, are related but distinct constructs, and they have different correlates and predictors. This was an important, not very many studies have measures of both of these kinds of well-being, and so it was important to basically investigate. Are these things just redundant? Are they all getting at some variation of the same thing? Or are they really meaningful conceptual distinctions? In this next section, I'm going to highlight just findings from a couple of studies that underscore the protective influences of eudaimonia in the face of challenge. And I'm going to start with the challenges of inequality. And here we look at well-being as a moderator variable between socioeconomic disadvantage and health outcomes. And the publication that I note here summarizes many different types of resilience in the MIDAS research prevailing in the face of adversity, not just about social educational hierarchy, but there are people in these lower levels of education who actually have high levels of purpose in life and other aspects of well-being. And that's how we can begin to look at them as potential moderator variables, which is what this study did. So this is a study where we first look at the link between educational status and a biomarker known as interleukin-6. What is interleukin-6? It's a marker of inflammation that is involved in the causal pathways to numerous disease endpoints as listed here. So this first graphic basically shows something that had already been known in the scientific literature. We were just replicating the finding. People with lower levels of educational attainment have higher levels of this biomarker. But this slide basically shows that those with high levels of well-being experience a protective effect against elevated interleukin-6 among those who are less educated. So on the x-axis, we're graphing levels of well-being across these different measures, and you see at the low end of well-being across these different measures, there is the same educational gradient in interleukin-6. The dark line is the bachelor's degree, the dotted line sorry, the dark, the black line is high school, and the hatched line, you can read them. I don't need to interpret the graph for you. The point is, when you get out to high levels of well-being, you see that the educational disadvantage is no longer evident in terms of levels of IL-6. This is a study that's not about eudaimonic well-being, but it's perhaps about precursors to eudaimonic well-being, and it is still about the topic of resilience. So we know from the MIDAS data set something about the economic status of the members of the sample when they were in childhood. Whether the family was on welfare, the educational status of parents. And what this study actually showed is that those who grew up under conditions of childhood poverty have higher prevalence of metabolic syndrome in adulthood. But there is, again, a protective benefit here from having high levels of maternal nurturance in childhood. Metabolic syndrome is measured in terms of these components. And again, you see the gradient in risk for metabolic syndrome measured in terms of number of the components or the diagnostic classification as a function of parents' educational status. But this is the key interaction finding, which essentially shows that individuals who grew up with high levels of maternal nurturance are protected against this risk of elevated metabolic syndrome, even if they grew up with low education parents. I also want to say just a little bit about the protective influence of eudaimonia in face of the challenges of aging. This is a work that uses well-being more as an antecedent variable. This is longitudinal work. But let's first just look at what we see in the age profiles of the components of well-being. And the main message from the original cross-sectional data, which was very disheartening to me, was to see these dramatically lower levels on purpose in life and personal growth among older members of the sample, both male and female. Those cross-sectional findings have been extended with longitudinal data. This is just a graphic showing you differences between time one and time two, a 9 to 10 year period in MIDAS. The different age groups, you can see the greatest decline happening among, in purpose in life, happening among the older respondents. And this publication here looks at these kinds of longitudinal profiles in two national studies and one other large cohort study, the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study, to basically document these are replicable changes in certain aspects of well-being as people age. But the main message is there's a lot of variability around those means. So there are older people who defy what the average looks like for their age, and older people who hang on to a deep sense of purpose in life have different profiles of mortality, morbidity, and they engage in more preventive health behaviors. So all of this next work is longitudinal. It's carefully done epidemiological research with a lot of covariates. This is from the MIDAS study that basically shows purpose in life buffers against mortality across adulthood. And I have three slides from the Rush Memory and Aging Project, which is done out of Rush University in Chicago. It's a community-based epidemiological study with over 1,200 people, 6 years over time. And this first finding basically showed that purpose in life also predicts longer lives. But this study went further to show that purpose in life at baseline also protects against risk of Alzheimer's disease and mild cognitive impairment over time. And further, this is a study where they get people to donate their brains after they die so that they can do post-mortem analyses of plaques and tangles in their brains after they've died. And this graph, these two graphs basically have different degrees of organic pathology on the x-axis, and on the y-axis you have how well was the person functioning cognitively while they were still alive. So when you get out to the far end of pathology, you see these two different lines that represent different levels of cognitive functioning while they were still alive, depending on what their level of purpose in life was. So these are really important findings that obviously call for further neurological explanation, but the point is purpose in life appears to even be protective against impairment in cognitive function in the face of high organic pathology in the brain. The Health and Retirement Study in the United States is actually run primarily by economists. It's a huge sample. I think they have now over 20,000 people. They've been studying them longitudinally for a very long time. Along the way, they brought in some of my measures of well-being, and people gravitated to purpose in life because of some of these other findings that were emerging. So these three publications were generated by a very energetic graduate student at the University of Michigan, Eric Kim. First showed that purpose in life reduces risk for myocardial infarction among adults with coronary heart disease. He then published another paper showing that purpose in life predicted reduced risk of stroke. And then I worked with him on the third paper in which purpose in life was shown to predict more preventive health behaviors, such as getting cholesterol screenings and cancer tests. So there's a lot of evidence building up around the protective benefits of certain of these aspects of eudaimonic well-being, especially people in the aging field are really gravitating to the focus on purpose in life. Just a couple slides here to emphasize what we have learned about brain mechanisms that sit behind some of these subjective experiences. So this publication basically shows that those with higher levels of purpose in life show better emotion regulation, measured in terms of eye blink reflex after negative provocation in the laboratory. And then this is a neuroimaging study, so some members of the MIDAS sample also participate in neuroimaging, where they are basically being subjected to different kinds of positive and emotional stimuli in the imaging magnet to see which parts of their brains are being activated and how those patterns change in a recovery profile. So this publication basically linked reward circuitry in the brain, the ventral striatum area, with eudaimonic well-being, and further linked those two connections to diurnal profiles of cortisol. The first key finding was that those who show more sustained engagement of reward circuitry in response to positive stimuli, this is all in milliseconds, this is not conscious, effortful maintaining of anything, this is happening automatically, but those who show more sustained engagement of reward circuitry when they're looking at positive stimuli are also those who report higher levels of psychological well-being. This is the total composite measure. And they also show reduced patterns of cortisol output over the day. So we have a very interesting linkage here between neural mechanisms in the brain, phenomenology, and cortisol profiles over the course of the day. Okay, promoting eudaimonia. I don't have time to go into the details here other than to say it is being done. It's absolutely being done. There is something called well-being therapy developed by Giovanni Fava at the University of Bologna. The first publication was in the Archives of Psychiatry. There were numerous subsequent publications. This is about promoting well-being among people who suffer from major depression and anxiety, showing 6-year follow-up effects. In Wisconsin, we have gotten involved in a preventive way in doing community interventions with older people in various counties in the state of Wisconsin. And a first set of findings from our pilot work, the program is called Lighten Up. And it's basically designed to give older people better skills for negotiating some of the challenges of later life. And this first publication showed benefits in terms of well-being For the older people participating in the program, it's an 8-week intervention program. And for those of you who are interested in a broader perspective on these both clinical and educational interventions, some are being done with children in school contexts. I'd be happy to share with you this chapter that Chiara Ruini and I recently completed for the Handbook of Positive Clinical Psychology. It's a kind of overview of using eudaimonia to improve lives. These are things we can fix, which I think is really important to underscore. So I'm down to my last slides, and I apologize for racing, but I want to make sure there's time for questions. And this is where I'm going out on, you will see I'm going progressively out on a limb in these last things, because I have reached a stage in my career development where I feel like it's important to talk about things that you think are really important and are not getting sufficient attention. This is not so much going out on a limb, but this is my angle for basically saying I would like to see a lot more engagement with the MIDAS data from economists. And I realize doing research on a US sample may not be something that everybody would choose as their first option. But I think work with the MIDAS data can potentially lead in important directions for making the case for trying to do parallel kinds of data collection in other other countries to promote a lot of international comparisons. And here what I want to draw attention to. Lots of people at this presentation, I've very much enjoyed what I've heard about those who are studying the impact of the economic recession, and I want to talk about some of the unique features of the MIDAS design for going after the impact of the economic recession. So this is a graphic that we had to create for our recent grant proposal to kind of try to get our arms around all of what's going on in this study over time. So you have the timeline for the assessments down here. Going across the top is the core longitudinal sample, the original baseline assessments with the national survey sample. We also had daily stress assessments in the original baseline. At MIDAS 2, which was done before the economic recession, we repeated the baseline survey assessments. We added a cognitive project, continued the daily stress project, added the biomarkers, the neuroscience. And we also are putting a big emphasis on inequalities in the context of race. So we recruited an oversample of African Americans from Milwaukee. We have just completed the third wave of survey and cognitive assessments. This work is currently under review in a grant proposal. But a really important part that I want to emphasize here is we were able to refresh. This stands for the MIDAS refresher sample. We were actually able to recruit a whole new baseline assessment of almost the equivalent number of people in the original survey assessment. So we have people of the same age and gender distribution after the economic recession that we can compare with these people of the similar age and gender before the recession. This also allows us to track impact of the recession in a pre-post fashion. So there are a lot of interesting opportunities here for going after assessments of the recession in a way that allows for far more, I think, informative analyses than can typically be done with data that are only collected after the economic recession. Okay. Another thing that I think is missing in contemporary research, this is me out on a limb, is the problem of unjust societies. So having worked in the area of inequalities for a long time, which it's a topic I care about greatly, I am struck by the fact that most of what we generate in terms of scientific findings is telling tales about the disadvantaged, which we need to tell. Those are really important tales that can become the basis maybe for public policy interventions. But I'm struck by the fact that we rarely tell tales about the privileged, and I mean the exceptionally privileged. Which leads me to be concerned about why do we see so little emphasis on the topic of greed? Greed as a of those at the top, where the motivation toward greed, I would argue, undermines the eudaimonic well-being of many, including middle-class Americans. So, okay, this is where I become a wild and crazy woman. But what got me thinking about greed actually was reading Dante's Inferno. And there are lots of things in Dante's Inferno, but among the sins that can explain why a person ended up in the Inferno are gluttony and greed and fraud and dishonesty. And I would argue that we all know that greed is a pernicious force in our lives, in our societies, corruption as well. I think it needs to be studied. I listed here, there are many people here who know far more about Adam Smith and the theory of moral sentiments than I do. But this really interesting article by Wright in 2005 summarized some of Adam Smith's perspectives on greed. He recognized self-interest can go awry and become out of control. The vain and insatiable lot do not know the limits of their own appetites. I think these issues relate in very important ways to growing degrees of inequality. I have not read Thomas Piketty's book. I've read a lot of editorials about it. I assign the editorials to my students in my classes. There's a strange thing going on in the U.S. in which we have surpassed the Gilded Age in degree of inequality that exists in contemporary U.S. society, so that middle-class Americans are not able to lead full and productive lives. And the amazing thing is that many people in U.S. society are oblivious to these degrees of inequality, which is part of why I think making an emphasis on these themes of inequality and also what is going on at the top with regard to allowances for extreme degrees of wealth at the top while others suffer. Okay, so that's kind of sour. Let me remind all of us that John Stuart Mill, I think, made an incredibly important observation in his autobiography. Those only are happy who have their minds fixed on some other object than their own happiness, on the happiness of others, on the improvement of mankind, even on some art pursuit, followed not as a means, but as itself an ideal end, aiming thus at something else, they find happiness by the way. And I just want to draw attention to wonderful work being done at the University of Humanistic Studies in Utrecht. I participated in a conference there in 2014. This was the theme of the conference, A Meaningful Life in a Just Society, Investigating Well-Being and Democratic Caring. I think it's difficult to come up with a better theme of a conference than that one. And this is basically saying, I think it's really important to have humanists at the scientific table. And that leads me to my third and last element of what I think is missing in the contemporary research. Here, I would underscore the potential of the arts and humanities in improving the human condition. It turns out this is happening in multiple places. The Royal Society for Public Health in the UK in 2013 published a 120-page article on art, health, and well-being. There's a whole new field now called health humanities. A recent book by Helen Small reviews the value of the humanities. Next week, I'm going to be speaking at the American Association of Colleges and Universities in the US. First time I've ever been at their meetings. A major new focus on education, higher education in America, is on the promotion of well-being, not just to improve individual lives, but to promote better, more responsible citizens. So this is leads me back to Midas. This is actually my last slide. I have realized over the course of my career that my passion in all of this is actually multidisciplinary research. And the reason I think multidisciplinary research is so incredibly important is because we all need to basically reach out to others who know more than we do. We are all products of our own training, our own disciplines. What we know is inherently limited. And so the beauty of the MIDAS study is that we have actually brought together these disciplines that represent the psychosocial factors we measure. We've brought in these disciplines that represent the sociodemographic factors, and we've also brought in many people from these fields that represent the neurobiological factors. But what's missing here are the humanities and the arts, which is an initiative I'm pursuing in the future that Luigino Bruni will be participating in. This is all by way of saying I think we need to keep growing the research that we do. Thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions.